Today, PGA Teacher of the Year, Ben Alexander.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, you'll get inside information on how to lower your scores through strategy and course management. We'll ask course pros, designers, and architects to reveal their secrets in an effort to improve your game. If you're a beginner or a seasoned pro, subscribe to the Golf Smarter podcast. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Hi there and welcome. Thanks for joining us on Golf Smarter. If you remember a few weeks ago, we talked to Bill Treadway, who's the founder of SAGA, the Society for Authentic Golf Architecture. And you may remember that we had a little contest and he gave away a couple memberships to the organization. Well, just to let you know, Bill has really anteed up and every person that entered the contest received a membership, which is incredibly generous because there's books involved and membership to NCGA and all these different things. So thank you, Bill, for your generosity. Also, stay tuned because we're going to have details. It's the last chance this week. Is the last chance you have to win a SkyCaddy handheld GPS rangefinder, and I'll give you all the details once again at the end of the program. Now, this past weekend, SAGA, that society we talked about, had their golf clinic down at Poppy Hills Golf Course at Pebble Beach. And my guess is, if you're a subscriber to the Golf Smarter podcast, I can assume two things. You play golf, and you've heard of both Pebble Beach and Poppy Hills. Now, to be completely honest, this was my first time to the Poppy Hills course, and I've still yet to play there. But it was a beautiful day on the coast, and the SAGA event featured some speakers and a couple of clinics, one on the driving range and another one of chipping and putting. While there, I was lucky enough to spend some time with a couple of people and record some interviews for the Golf Smarter podcast. Today's interview will feature the PGA teaching professional of Poppy Hills, Ben Alexander. He was also named the 2004 PGA Teacher of the Year for the Northern California PGA sections. Now, as the interview begins, I'm asking Ben to show off his ring.
I'm sorry?
Show everyone your ring.
Oh, the ring, the teacher of the year ring. Yeah, it is pretty. It's got a nice purple stone in it, and it's a diamond, and it says PGA Teacher of the Year, and very excited to have it. It's a real treasure.
That's quite an honor. How do you get to be PGA Teacher of the Year?
Well, we have sections of the PGA all around the country, and the Northern Cal PGA section governs Northern California, San Luis Obispo up to Oregon to Lake Tahoe area. We have about 1,100 PGA professionals in our region, and once a year, about six or eight of us are nominated. And when we're nominated, then we're sent a form of very pertinent questions. We have an awards committee that are fellow PGA professionals. And they evaluate you against other teachers that have been nominated. And there's a lot of questions that you fill out that they ask you on the forms, about three pages worth. Things like, how many lessons do you give? What is your style of teaching? Have you written national articles? What is your junior golf program? Things about how long you've been teaching and what have you done different than the other person, and that's what they're looking for. And what is your support system with teaching? And I have a great coaching system. I have people email me after every lesson. So to see, like if I was working with you, Fred, I'd say, well, Fred, this is what we worked on today, and email me tonight when you get home, and I'll look at the email, I'll send it back to you. And after I read your email, I'll kind of critique it. I'll say, Fred, this looks great, or this is nothing at all what we talked about.
I didn't know that I was going to take a golf lesson and have to test afterwards. What do you ask them to email you about?
Well, you only work with one, maybe two points. So if we changed your grip today because you were slicing, I would have you email me and just like you're talking to me and say, Ben, this is what we worked on. You adjusted my grip so I could see three knuckles in the back of my left hand where I could only see maybe one knuckle before. So you adjusted my hands to where I could see three knuckles in the back of the left hand. And now I can start drawing the ball a little bit better. The way we've taught as teaching professionals over the years, Fred, is that we have said, well, Fred, here's your lesson. Here's what we're doing today. I'll see you in a couple of weeks and call me when you're ready for the next lesson. A lot of golfers will try and remember their lesson in their head. And then you get into the driving range lesson, then you get into the short game, and then you start working with chipping and putting and pitching. And all of a sudden, the old TMI, too much information, starts getting on overload, where the instructor's maybe only giving them a few simple things to work on, but the student on their own can't repeat it back to you what they're trying to cover. And they're willing to pay you money, but they can't really repeat what your lessons are sometimes. So I came up with coaching, which a lot of pros have, to where you have to have a backup system, and that's where the emails come in, because most people have a computer. And this is what we did with the grip today. This is what I was doing. This is what we did today. I'll email it back to you. I said, Fred, this looks great. Print it out, and now you've got a copy of our first lesson. But if you print out each lesson, sand trap and chipping and putting and woods and irons, and, you know, it kind of works with that.
And it reinforces everything that they've been doing.
Reinforces everything. And that's where I think we as professionals had to step up to the plate more, to where we could reinforce more with our students per the free 15-minute tune-ups. And I'm giving away a lot of free time where I could be booking it for cash. But I think my main concern is, I know my main concern is to make sure the golfer gets my best, and also they learn and are able to learn from what they've taken away from the lesson.
Communication for you is more than just being out on the golf course and giving a lesson and showing a person where to put their hands. It's ongoing communication with your students.
It is. You develop a relationship with your students because they trust you. They put a lot of trust in you because they care a lot about their golf. And the best players to teach, of course, are beginners because they don't come in with any baggage or bad habits. The hardest lessons to teach are the persons that's been playing for a year or more, because he or she has some bad habits that they've brought into the lesson. And now it's your job to figure out, A, how they learn. Are they a visual learner? Are they a verbal learner? Do they learn strictly through kinesiology of movement? Most people, you know, are movement, kinesiology, and also visual. You can only yak at somebody so much. I always related to how you ride a bicycle. You can tell a person for 3 days how to ride that bike, but he or she's not going to know until they get on it and feel the seat and feel the pedals moving and the balance you're going to get and all that. So the communication, that's why we as teachers and professionals, PGA professionals, we're always going to continuing education seminars that we go to. I was at one in February with Jim Flick, the Northern Cal PGA. We have a teaching conference for 2 days every year in Sacramento at the Capitol Hyatt. And I'm on the committee with my good friend Laird Small over here at the Pebble Beach Golf Academy, and Ken Morton from Hagen Oaks, some other great professionals. And we're the ones that put the whole thing together. And every year we get a famous teacher coming in. This year we had Jim Flick. Last year we had Jim McLean. The year before that we had Dave Pels. We had Butch Harmon. We had Hank Haney. And these guys are there with us all day long. And we can tap them for all the information we want. They lecture to us. We talk to them. We have lunch with them. And we go to these seminars to be able to learn how to teach simpler and to teach better. And the communication is what we're always trying to do better. And when you, it's amazing to me that I can tell a person something, and then 3 minutes later they'll do something completely opposite, because that's where I have to keep the coaching going. If I mention to have the person keep their weight on their left foot when they're chipping, and all of a sudden they make three or four chip shots and the weight's on the right foot, I'll say, remember a few minutes ago we talked about the weight on the left foot? Oh, that's right, that's right. And then it's the continual repetitiveness, and you know, it's just doing it over and over again. And I might have tell this one guy to do it 30 times. And once he hears it over and over and over again, that's how you learn. It's through repetitives, and, you know, repeating and coaching. And you never want to make a student feel like they're being browbeaten at all, or hassled, or talked down to. You always want to act as the glass is always half full. You're there to coach. You're there to support them, and you're on their side. I think what separates the great teachers from the average teachers, if you will, is the coaching programs they have, the fact that we as teachers always keep learning. My teacher, who was John Geertsen, who was a very famous teacher in this area, always taught me as a teacher, you never stop learning. And I've always had that hunger to keep learning, to do it better and to do it simpler.
I'll tell you, I would love to show up Sacramento with my tape recorder, because I know this audience. If I can get a hold of a bunch of teachers to interview and get more tips and more ways of improving the game through the mental part of the game, instead of just let's talk. I don't want to talk about mechanics. I don't want to talk about technique. I want to talk about the mental part of the game. I think that we'd get a lot of great tips. All right, you've established that you are an excellent teacher, because of the accolades that you've received. But what we haven't established is that you're a very lucky man. You get to teach in probably one of the most beautiful places in the world, where the smart people don't wear shorts to play golf.
That's right. Yeah,
we haven't told anybody where you're from, where you teach.
Poppy Hills Golf Course in Pebble Beach, California.
Not everyone knows Poppy Hills, but they know Pebble Beach.
Right, they know Pebble Beach Golf Course. They know Spyglass.
What are they, sister courses?
No.
How does this work?
No, we actually have, inside the Pebble Beach community, we have six golf courses. The Pebble Beach Company, which is Clint Eastwood, Peter Uberoff, and Arnold Palmer. They own Pebble Beach, Spyglass, and Spanish Bay, and they own Del Monte Golf Course, which is over here in Monterey. That's the Pebble Beach Company. Cypress Point is a separate company, privately owned. Down the street from us is Monterey Peninsula Country Club. It's been there since the 1920s, and they're privately owned. They have private membership, and we're owned at Poppy Hills. We are owned and operated by the Northern California Golf Association. And we opened up in June of 86, and the AT&T now, for the last 16 years, has been played here at Poppy Hills, along with Pebble and Spyglass, all throughout the week. There are 101 golf associations nationally, and a lot of people don't know about all of them, and I certainly don't know every one of them, but the USGA is based back in New Jersey, Far Hills, New Jersey. That's the United States Golf Association. And every state, and California is so big, we have two golf associations, Northern Cal Golf Association and Southern California Golf Association. And all the various states, I was in Utah a few weeks ago as a guest teacher at the Utah Salt Lake City Golf Show, and I met the people from the Utah Golf Association. So every state has a golf association that governs golf. And what we did at Poppy Hills, we built our own golf course. And out of the 101 amateur golf associations in America that are under the umbrella of the USGA, our facility gathered monies together, and we opened up our own golf course in 1986. And I started here shortly after that. And
so your official title is?
PGA Teaching Professional at Poppy Hills Golf Course. And we have what's called NCGA members, men and women like yourself who play here. They have an NCGA card, and they get to play the golf course for I think it's around $50 Monday through Thursday and $60 on the weekends, whereas the actual green fee to play Poppy Hills is about $150. And so we have the general public playing here from all over the world, plus NCGA. And the NCGA people can, you can come here and play for $50 or $60, and you can bring up to three guests with you at a major discounted rate, along with Joe and Sally and Charlie and everybody else that plays here from all over the country, and they pay the regular green fee to play here.
Can you help us figure out how to find a good golf instructor?
Yeah, that's a challenge sometimes, because who does a PGA professional go to for lessons? Well, I would contact one of my colleagues in this area, and I've actually called my friend Laird Small, who's with the Pebble Beach Golf Academy, and he gave me a lesson quite a while back. Who do we go to? I mean, you know, and it's something you have to go to somebody that you know about and respect, and you know their credentials. For the average player, what the average player does, and I think they make the mistake in doing this, is that they will go and take a lesson from somebody before they know very much about that teacher's background. And golf professionals in the PGA and also apprentice golf professionals with the PGA who are PGA apprentices, we are all at different levels in our careers of golf. We have to serve an apprenticeship that's anywhere from 5 to 7 years, hopefully gaining your PGA membership after you go through school. And a lot of assistant pros teach. I was an assistant pro and taught when I was an apprentice years ago. There's a few of us that are full-time teachers, and there's a lot of head pros that teach. So I recommend to the average player, wherever you live around the country and around the world, to find your local golf course, and normally they have a head professional there and two or three pros on staff, and find out, A, who teaches. Sit down and over a glass of water, a cup of coffee, and talk to them for a while. See if you get on with them well.
What should you be asking, though? What are we looking for?
How many years have you been teaching? How many lessons do you give a week?
And what kind of numbers should I be looking for in lessons a week?
Well, in my opinion, if you're...
I'm asking your opinion.
In my opinion, when you're in the when you're in the golf shop and you're working behind the counter for 40 or 50 hours a week, you're not going to have a lot of time to teach. Now, you might teach maybe 3 or 4 or 5, 6 lessons a week, maybe. I give 110 lessons a month on an average. There's some pros that teach less than that, some that teach more. But what I would ask is how many lessons do you teach? I would like to find out a teacher that teaches full-time, or if the pro is a head pro or an assistant pro, teaching is a big part of their job. So they're working in the golf shop along with teaching on the lesson tee. There are some assistant pros out there and head professionals that really don't teach very much at all. They're pretty much wrapped up in the pro shop operations. So that's what you'd ask them, is that how many lessons do you give a month? What is your focus? Is it on teaching 50%, golf shop 50%? Or I want to have somebody teaching me that does it a lot. And that's what eventually the assistant pros are going to do once they become head pros, because there are a lot of head pros that have the ability to leave the golf shop maybe for two or three lessons a day, and they can maybe get 15, 20 in a week. And so the head pro is teaching usually a lot more than the assistant pro is, because the assistant pro is kind of behind the register. They're answering the telephone. They're taking reservations and all that. So I'd like to find out how much they teach. And if they're teaching probably 15, 20 lessons a week, I'd feel pretty good with that. If they're teaching maybe one a week or three or four a month, I would personally look for somebody that teaches more.
And what about individual lessons versus groups?
Mm-hmm.
Working in a group or learning in a group?
Yeah. I prefer the private lessons. All I've done at all, I've done the golf school, the Golf Clinic Golf School, which is a school in Pebble Beach where we had people here for 5 days, 3 days, 4 days, a full day, staying at the hotels. I've also done the private lessons, one-on-one, which are 45-minute lessons. I've also done the groups where you do 5 or 6 weeks, pretty much 5 weeks, you know, $99 for 5 one-hour lessons. I don't do classes very much anymore because they require a lot of organization, and quite honestly, you don't. They take a lot of time. And the private lessons, I get a lot more accomplished. So if I work with a student, I like to work one-on-one. Now, the general public, who are beginners, we find that the general public goes to beginner golf classes because there's safety in numbers. They figure if there's 10 or 12 people there, they're not going to get embarrassed if there's a lot of people there, where they are so worried about getting embarrassed if they're just one-on-one. And there's no problem with being embarrassed because they're new. And we expect them to do that because they're going to hit lousy shots because they're there to learn. But the reality is most people will start off, men and women will start off going to a class first, test the water to see if they like the game. And that's nothing wrong with that at all. And after they do 5 or 6 classes, they kind of get the basics given to them, how to hold the club, how to swing, how to putt, how to chip. But to really get better, you have to go, my opinion, you have to go to private lessons because you have 100% of my time as compared to a golf class where you have one instructor for 10 or 12 people. Because if you got an hour golf class for 10 or 12 people, you got one or two instructors, they're bouncing from Fred to Sally to John to Mary, and they're going back to you. So reality is you get maybe 7 or 8 minutes of private instruction. But I think you get a lot more accomplished one-on-one because we can do video with you. We can send the my video system here is just great. We have a memory stick, a little USB flash drive you put in there, and you can take your lesson home with you that you can watch on the computer. You can't do that with a golf class. And plus, a lot of people don't have golf clubs. So golf classes are great for beginners to kind of test the water, see if they like the game. But the next step is to do the private lessons. And I prefer if people come in for private lessons right off the get-go because I'll provide clubs for them. And then, but some people like the social atmosphere, too. So, you know, people are offered all that, golf classes. And I've done ladies-only classes. I've actually found the ladies-only classes fill up a lot better than the co-ed classes. Because you'll get like 9 or 10 ladies there because they enjoy the getting together. But also, men don't seem to like to do classes very much from what I found. There's some that do, but not as many as compared to the ladies.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, tips and drills.
Okay.
I'm going to pick your brain on that.
Sounds good.
As we make the churn, we want you to know that we're taking requests. If you'd like us to feature a specific course on Golf Smarter, our email address is golfsmarter@ttour.com. That's Golf Smarter, one word, at TEETOUR.com. Whether you're planning a golf vacation, playing in an upcoming tournament, or have a favorite course for which you have a question, please let us know and we'll do a show just for you. Again, here's your host for Golf Smarter, Fred Green.
All right, we're back with Ben Alexander from Poppy Hills. Been teaching here forever, been playing here a lot, I'm sure. Pick a hole. Let's pick one or two of your favorite holes here at Poppy Hills, and tell me how to strategically attack a course like this.
Well, number 12 here is a dogleg right, where it's a complete 90-degree dogleg, and you have to almost lay up your tee shot. If you hit it too far, you can hit it in through the trees in the next hole. You have out of bounds right, and you have trouble with trees left. So a good play is to only hit the shot about 190 yards because a lot of people pull out their driver not knowing that it's kind of a long par 5.
I would think that a lot of people play here have never played here.
Well, a lot of them haven't, right, exactly. And it's Robert
Trent Jones. How do you know?
Well, we have it's on the scorecard, and also now we have GPS. But a lot of times, if you don't have all that stuff, you know, you just go by sight.
But a GPS is going to tell you how far to the hole, not that if you have a dog leg to.
Well, the GPS systems we have here actually show you to the bunkers and to the different okay. the different parts of the hole. But I still like just looking at it, you know, and you can kind of tell about how far a few hundred yards is, and if you think there's any question at all about getting in trouble with your driver of hitting it too far through the fairway. A lot of people can hit like a three wood or a five wood off the tee because you have trouble right out of bounds. You can go too far straight and put you in the trees, and you got trees left. So the thing is just like a lion out there is ready to take your ball and run with it. So a good way to play that hole, it's a three-shot hole no matter what. So a good way to play that hole is about a 200-yard drive and just get it right around the corner, and then it's going to be about 350 yards to the green. The fairway is lined with bunkers. And it's about 300 to the green. And I like people to hit it about 170, 180, and leaves them about 120 into the green. So it's a lot of people who are playing this hole, in my opinion, they'll hit the driver. Sometimes they're in trouble out of bounds, so they're reloading right there at that point, or they put it in trouble. Or sometimes they'll put it right down the middle. And then their next shot, they're pulling out a three wood, and it's still out of bounds all the way down to the right. It's a cart path, out of bounds trees. And they're pulling out the three wood, and there's no way in the world they can make it to the green because it's 300 yards plus. So then they hit a shot, and they're either well short of it or they put it in the bunkers. Now they got a 60-yard bunker shot, and now they're looking at double bogey, triple bogey. And number 12 is a great example because the PGA Tour came in here in 1992, and we used to have bunkers at the dogleg point. So as you made the dogleg to the right, there were bunkers there. And the PGA Tour had them redesign it to where they took the bunkers out so the pros could try and cut it around the corner. And a lot of the pros do try and cut it around the corner so they make the green in two. And if they're lucky enough to get around the corner, then they can get on there with a couple hundred-yard shot. But number 12 is a great hole because it's kind of the sneaky, long, tough shot hole. You really have to strategically play the shots. Without all the GPS and all the other stuff, just go by your sight and your gut feel. If you think there's any way you can get in trouble, downsize a little bit and hit a five wood rather than a driver. And another hole out here is the second hole we have here. And have you played Poppy Hills, Fred? Have you played it before?
I have not. I'm embarrassed to say.
Well, the second hole is it's over a canyon, and it plays anywhere from about 215 yards to about 140. Depends on where the tees are at. And the tee sets up on an elevated green, and
are you talking about different tees or
yeah we have different tees and different
okay,
different
so
sets of tees
okay
and the tour tees for the PGA Tour are about 210 215 when they play the green, you know, all the way back. A lot of times all you want to do is get over the canyon and you know, just play it as a par four even though it's a par three hole. Because it's a very small hitting area, and strategically playing the course for course management, what I like to do is that tell my amateur players who are very high handicaps, play this hole, whatever it is, par 3, par 4, par 5, play it as a bogey hole. So like on this par 3 over the canyon, let's just play this as a par 4. I don't care where you end up, just get it over the canyon to start with. And then you might have a little 20-yard pitch shot to the green, two putt, you're out of there with a par. Rather than trying to go for the green, and you'd have to see this hole, but you've got a canyon in front of you where the ball is down the deep ravine, if you will. You've got bunkers on your right. You've got bunkers on your left. There's trees in the back, so you have to have a very exacting shot to hit it about 170 to 190 on an average shot for the average player. And most people can't hit long irons and even the hybrids that accurate. So I just say get it over there, hit it about 110 yards, just get it over the canyon. Play a little 20 or 30-yard pitch shot to the green, two putts, you're out there with a par. On a par 5, I'll tell my students when I do playing lessons to go and play that par 5 hole as a par 6 and play it for 6 shots, because reality is a 20 handicap is going to get a bogey anyway on it. So if you tell them to play as a par 6, it gives them a little bit of room to breathe, not quite as much pressure on them to try and get the par. So have them play maybe 4 shots to the green, you know, rather than trying to get on the par 5 and 3. Two putts, you're out of there with a par. On a par 4 hole, play 3 shots to the green, which they're going to do pretty much anyway, and then have 3 shots to get on the green and hopefully get your par out of there. Maybe get a 6 or a 5 out of it. But try and stay away from the triples and the quadruple bogeys and the 9s that we see on so many scorecards. But if you can play every hole on the golf course, wherever you play around the country, around the world, as a bogey hole, it gives you the mental freedom to be able to have a little bit more room to screw up. You know what I mean? Because an average golfer who is a 25 handicap, 20 handicap, 10 handicap, you want to make sure that they are able to go ahead and play the hole to where they can play it almost as a bogey hole.
Can course management be taught?
Yeah.
Why isn't it? And is it? I mean, it seems to be more on mechanics and technique and grip and, you know, but for scoring purposes, isn't course management really important?
It is important. It can be taught. And if you think about how many lessons are given, the students don't get to the golf course very much with the instructor. It's usually on the lesson tee for working on your full swing. It's usually on the short game area working on your putting, chipping, and bunkers. You have to do the course management when you include a playing lesson in with your program. Now, what I've done with my playing lessons, I still do the hour out on the golf course with them. And if they're doing a series of five lessons with me or however many lessons we're doing, I like to include the playing lesson. Sometimes you can take the student out for the very first time on the very first lesson to see how they are playing out in the golf course. That gives you a tremendous assessment as an instructor and tremendous information on what they're doing well and not doing well. Sometimes I'll do a playing lesson on the fifth lesson out of five to where I get them out there on the golf course for three holes. And either, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, 8:30, we go out on the back nine here at Poppy Hills. If the first group of the day is teed off at 7:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, I go out on about the 13th or 14th hole. And we'll have the student play three or four holes. And before we go, I'll say, well, Fred, what's the weaker part of your game? I mean, what do you see that's giving you trouble when you're playing? And you'll tell me,
showing up.
You know? Well, I'm not hitting the ball on the green in regulation very much. I'm having a lot of trouble from 150 yards in. So we take that bucket of balls out with us in the golf cart, have you hit 10 or 15 balls from 150 yards, from 120 yards. And I also will have you do for the course management portion of it, I'll just let you play a little bit on your own. I'll watch what shots you're playing. And I'll watch to see, like we did in our class today, if they're putting the ball when it's off the green and then chipping the ball with a 7-iron first shot, or are they pulling out their sand wedges to chip all chip shots with. I just kind of watch what they do. And that's part of course management. It's shot assessment and also managing the golf course on the way the course is laid out from what the architects did. And I don't think a lot of us as pros are getting the people out there on the course as much as we should. And I've learned at teaching seminars, as a teacher going to seminars, we are taught by these great teachers who we go to, hearing the Hank Caneys and the Butch Harmons and the Jim Flicks and these guys, that you need to get golfers target-oriented. You know, it's a target game, and you need to get them out on the golf course to see what they're doing. Because what do you and I hear? I'm a great driving range player, and I get out on the golf course, and I'm lousy. It's like I'm two different guys. I hit the ball well in the range, I get to the course, and I can't score a lick. So we get out there and get them on the golf course to work on course management. Now, course management is taught by adding into, like, here, your ball is here. Should you putt the ball or should you chip the ball? So knowing how to hit the shots or having a database of your shots to hit, if a student doesn't have those, that's where you, of course, get it in the instruction part of it as well. But like on that number 12 hole, like we talked about a while ago, I would say, well, you know, let's hit your driver here. Let's hit a 5-wood and let's hit a hybrid club. And then let's play all three shots to the green. And you tell me after we played the hole, what was the easiest of you to play out of all these three shots? And that's helping them assess the course management and the strategic part of playing the golf course. And they, by doing, gee, I hit that driver pretty good, but it was a lot safer shot with that 5-wood. You see, and that's part of that.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Just to keep everybody's ego in check here, and I think that there's too much ego involved in golf as it is, what is an average golfer? You talked about this earlier this afternoon at the clinic that you were doing for Saga, but what is an average golfer?
As far as handicap? Well, the average golfer shoots into the high 90s and the low 100s. And that's probably a 25 handicap or above. You know, I still call them handicaps. I know they're called indexes now. But the average golfer shoots probably 90, 95 into 105 range.
You had a statistic today about people breaking 100.
Yeah, I forgot who did the study, but they did a study a while back. And over the last 20 years, the average golfer out of 35 million golfers that we now have in America that play golf, and over the last 20 years, the average golfer still shoots in the 100 range. And they got these statistics through all the various golf associations from around the country. And all they had to do was call the Northern Cal Golf Association or the Utah Golf Association, and they can find out what is the average score that is turned into your golf association over the period of a year or a period of 20 years. They keep all that data. Amazing. And the average score was into the 95s to the 105s and through that range. And the question came out over this study, well, then with all the lessons, with all the teachers, with all the technology, with all the Golf Channel stuff, why don't people get better? And it was an interesting thing, kind of a...
Was there an answer?
Well, the actual answer came out once you started digging into finding out what the practice habits of people were, how much time they put into practice, and how much time they put into lessons. Then it came down to the lessons, you know, what type of lessons were they getting. And so a lot of golfers practice very poorly. And a lot of golfers will just practice on the day they're going to play. And they'll just do a few putts and a few chips and a few range shots, and that's their practice. That's only a warm-up, but they're considering it practice. So once it actually kind of got broken down, they found out that people's practice habits were not very good. And obviously life gets in the way. Family,
well,
kids, jobs.
Golf is time-consuming.
It is.
And,
yeah.
You know, just to play it. But and then you want to practice, too? No, I want to go out and play golf. I don't want to practice.
And I got to tell you, Fred, I believe it's the Indian, not the arrow. I think clubs can only help you so much. And I also believe that you can go to the practice range and practice 7 days a week and hit 10 of those great big teaching baskets that we have out there and maybe get worse. So practice habits, people have to practice well, because perfect practice doesn't make perfect. But you're out there trying to do the best you can, and I recommend to people, you know, that's what I do in my teaching program. I try and get you to do the 50-50 rule. And this relates to the people shooting in the 100 range, because a lot of people weren't getting better, partially because they didn't have the time, you know, because of job commitments and where they live and family and all that. But the people that did have the time to practice, I like the 50-50 to have you take two or three clubs, like a pitching wedge, 7, 8, 9 iron to the range, and just hit those clubs on the range for 20 or 30 minutes, then go over and practice in the bunker for 20 or 30 minutes. Next time you go to the driving range, take your pitching wedge to warm up, and then hit your 5, 6, 7 and hybrid clubs, maybe 4 or 5 clubs. Practice on the chipping. And then what we're getting at is 50-50. Practice the short game at least equal to the long game.
Well, where's the scoring done?
Short game, and from 40, 50 yards in. And so then, same thing, you go practice hitting the woods after you warmed up with a wedge, and then work on the pitch shots and the bunker shots, you know. I would prefer you practicing short game 2-1. And a lot of facilities, quite honestly, around the country don't have good practice facilities. You know, you've been around, you know, and Poppy Hills, we're blessed here. I was not raised on fancy courses like these. I was raised in Southern California on the average municipal course. And they had a little bit of grass on the tees on the range, and we were happy for that, you know, and maybe a putting green. But now a lot of golf architects, you know, are building practice facilities that really have good practice facilities at golf courses. At the lecture that he was talking about this morning, Bob, the gentleman that was talking about how much land do you have to work with to build your golf course? How much money do you have to build your facility? I think every facility should have a bunker, a chipping green, and a pitching area. But a lot of golf courses don't even have chipping greens. They just have a putting green where they won't let you chip on. Right. And they have a range, and they don't have a bunker. So how's the man or woman going to practice their short game if they don't have a bunker at the golf facility? They don't have a golf chipping green. And that's one reason why a lot of golfers don't get better and haven't gotten better, because a lot of the facilities they have to access don't have the accessibility for what they need to use. And that's all part of the scenario.
Share with us, if you can, your favorite short game drill.
Oh, gosh. Well, I like to kind of add the putting.
Now we're in the classroom.
Now we're in the classroom. I kind of like we did in the clinic today. Putting's 50% of your strokes on your scorecard if you do it well. If you two-putt every green, that's 36 putts, and 36 is 50% of 72. So there's your 50% right there. So I like to do the putting where I like to take two golf balls on the putting green and take two golf balls and put it about 4 feet away from the cup. You know, so you got these two golf balls 4 feet away. And don't leave that spot till you put those two balls in. And after you put those two balls in a few minutes, move back to 8 feet. Don't move from that spot until you put those two balls in. Then your last point is 12 feet. So now you've gone from 4 feet to 8 feet to 12 feet. And as you start moving back farther, obviously the putts become harder. And normally most people get the four-footers in within a few minutes, and a little bit harder for the eight-foot. But what it does, that really helps you grind in almost like a tournament atmosphere. I'm not leaving this spot till I get those balls in. And I think that's good, the good one for the putting. I like to do the chipping on a fairly flat surface to kind of get a feel of the chipping stroke. Like we did during the clinic, take an iron and lay the iron down next to your golf ball and point the grip at the intended target where you're trying to go, and just use that shaft of the iron to help you develop your pendulum stroke with your 7-iron or your pitching wedge or your sand wedge, whatever club you're using to chip with. But work with that iron on the ground to make sure that you can keep that pendulum motion. So you got the putting where you're working on the 4, 8, and 12-foot drill, and then you got your chipping where you lay a club on the ground. You can really develop that pendulum stroke to keep the club square to square.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's awesome. All right, last one.
Okay.
As a golfer, the best advice you've ever received?
Get into a stretching program, because I'm 55 now, and I've lost a lot of weight with the Jenny Craig program and stayed with the program pretty well. But I've been stretching now for about 10 years, because aside from the golf part of it, when we were 16, 17 years old in school, 30, 40 years ago, whatever that was, they always had us do stretching and limbering up and loosening up exercises before we attempted to do the sport that we were going out for. Now that we're 30, 40, 50 in that range, whatever the ages are, we need stretching 10 times more than we ever did. So use a heating pad at home in the morning for about 5, 10 minutes. Loosen your back up. Get on the carpet for maybe 5 minutes. Do some stretching, which is any physical therapist can give you to help stretch your muscles out, your arms, your shoulders, your legs. Because if you don't stretch for 5 to 10 minutes every morning before you go out for your day, not stretching on the day you're going to play golf. That's like being on a diet one day a week. But stretch, 10, 15 minutes in the morning after you've used a heating pad. And then keep your flexibility available to you to where you're not prone to injury. Because if you don't stretch and you're attempting to play this crazy game of golf, you're opening yourself up for injury. And you start getting injuries, you can't play golf as well. You're not going to have as much fun.
Awfully good advice, wouldn't you agree? I just stretch every morning. I have to. And that was Ben Alexander, PGA 2004 Teacher of the Year in the NorCal section. You can go to benalexandergolf.com, find out more. He also has a DVD called Walk Fast and Swing Slow. And on it, he's got 10 tips that are pretty valuable. Sand wedge, chip, and run shot, alignment, the turn, uphill, downhill, blah, 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 blah. So why don't you check that out, benalexandergolf.com. And interesting, one of the things that he told me was that Tom Tatnall was one of his instructors when he was learning to become a PGA professional, and is also the one who handed him his diploma. And I bring up Tom Tatnall because that takes us to Sky Caddy. If you're new to the show and you haven't heard yet, we're giving away a Sky Caddy handheld GPS rangefinder. And that was announced on the Tom Tatnall interview a couple weeks ago. And you can get all the details about the giveaway. But also, you should hear the interview if you've not yet, because it really is excellent. If this guy right here, Ben Alexander, says he was my teacher, that's got to tell you something. He also said that he worked with Joe Hallett, which is another interview that we did months ago. So you can check those out if you haven't heard them already. So if you want to win a Sky Caddy handheld GPS rangefinder, all you have to do is send us an email. Put your name and where you're from in the email. It really helps to know where you're from. And explain why you think you should have a Sky Caddy. I'm just curious. It's not going to make any difference, because we're going to have a random drawing for this thing next week, and we'll announce the winner on next week's program. And send it to Sky Caddy in your subject. Send it to golfsmarter@ttour.com. We'll announce the winner next week. And if you want details on it, go to the May 30th program with Tom Tatnall, and you'll get all the information about that. Want to mention Bunkershot.com. Check them out. It's a good website. And also, we're starting something else. Always trying to do something new here. Frapper.com/golfsmarter. Frapper is frapper.com/golfsmarter. They've got this little map of the world, and it shows where the Golf Smarter listeners are. And maybe we can even start a dialogue. It's not just me doing the talking anymore, which I hope I don't do too much of, and I am right now. We can start doing a chat room type of thing if you want to have communication with other golfers and see if they have any recommendations of courses that you're going to that I don't know about. But, of course, you can always write to me and find out more about that as well. You know, last thing, the U.S. Open was pretty painful to watch the ending. And I think Mickelson all taught us you don't have to be a great ball striker to be a great golfer. Isn't that the truth? I mean, all the Golf Smarter listeners will probably go, you don't need the driver on this hole. Man, you just gotta golf smarter. Thanks for listening. I'm Fred Green.